Welcome to episode 14, The Truth About Winston Churchill. Was Churchill a saint or a sinner? History has left us with an airbrushed impression of this infamous character, who is touted the greatest Briton of all time, and widely regarded as being among the most influential people in British history. Consistently ranking well in the opinion polls of prime ministers of the United Kingdom, yet his highly complex legacy continues to stimulate intense debate amongst writers and historians, and for good reason, as you will hear about in this episode. David and Michael welcome back author and researcher Deanna Spingola to discuss another side of the story that shines a new light on Churchill, and also on the period of the First and Second World Wars that have shaped the modern age as we know it. You are listening to the Unslaved Podcast. Please welcome Michael Tesarian and David Whitehead.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome. Thanks for tuning in to the Unslaved Podcast. So happy to be here once again. And we're here joined once again by the great Deanna Spingola. We're so happy to have her back again. And we're going to be getting into some very, very interesting things that you may not know about regarding Winston Churchill. He's been popping up again in the news, and there's a lot of information that we're going to be covering going through some of Deanna's books. And Deanna, we're so glad to have you back to talk about this. And before we get into it, I have a few quotes that we're going to read from Churchill himself, which is always great to hear right from the horse's mouth.
Literally, and yes.
Exactly. And what Churchill says, he says something very interesting. He goes, "Everything tends towards catastrophe and collapse. I am interested, geared up, and happy. Is it not horrible to be built like that? The preparations have a hideous fascination for me. I pray to God to forgive me for such fearful moods of levity. Yet I would do my best for peace, and nothing would induce me wrongfully to strike the blow." There's another quote here that's interesting where he says, "I think a curse should rest on me because I love this war. I know it's smashing and shattering the lives of thousands every moment, and yet I can't help it. I enjoy every second of it." So, Deanna, before we head to you, I know Michael wanted to comment briefly on those quotes. So, Michael, how's it going? Let's get into it.
Fine. Nice to be back with you both. Actually, I have a third quote from David Frumkin from his book, A Peace to End All Peace.
For some reason, Michael, we can't hear you. Can you hear Michael, Deanna?
No.
Okay. For some reason, we can't hear you, Michael.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, it was my
fault.
There
we go. Okay. All right, take it away from there.
Okay. Well, actually, I have a third quote from David Frumkin, A Peace to End All Peace, which is a book that, like so many, grovels at Churchill, even though, of course, some peccadilloes are mentioned. But anyway, the quote is, "Aubrey Herbert, who served in the armed forces there," this is in the Middle East, "wrote in his diary that Winston's name fills everyone with rage. I would like him to die in some of the torments I've seen so many die in here." So the quotes you read show him as a bona fide psychopath, reveling in delight about the conflagrations. And this one again shows that people in the field, the ones actually going doing the dying, were incensed by this politician. And as a matter of fact, even other psychopaths like Kitchener couldn't stand to be back in Britain, number one. They preferred to be out in the middle of nowhere, in the far reaches of the empire. They didn't like coming back to civilization. And second reason they didn't like to do it is because they didn't want to even smell a politician. And they're always being summoned to these political, you know, to 10 Downing Street and to these clubs. And these men hated these politicians on sight. But we have Deanna here, so I would just like to say that her books, she has three in the Ruling Elite series, and they're absolutely compulsory reading. And the second book, A Zionist Seizure of Power, is probably one of the best books I've read on any subject, but certainly on Churchill. It goes into it. But then she's got an awesome third book called Death, Destruction, and Domination. It's another one in the series of the Ruling Elite. That is just replete with scathing exposures of Winston Churchill. So anyone listening to Son of a Voice who wants to hone in on that man's life, because a lot of history surrounds him. If you study Churchill, it's just like a lot of the greats, even if you study something like Rasputin or the Tsar, right? But certainly if you study this creature called Winston Churchill, that's a history lesson in a capsule because of his times, the life and times. But made no mistake about it, he was a colossal psychopath, you know, and I'm no fan of Adolf Hitler, but given the bad press that Hitler's had, it's actually a lot of it is deservedly put at the door of Winston Churchill, because he was worse in almost all respects, a scurrilous creature, you know, and, we've speculated before even about, you and I, David, about which bullet dodgers in history, you know, if they had have died, what would have happened? And if some of them had survived, what would have happened? Well, here's one who definitely dodged the bullet and did indeed change history for the worst. And yet the man is universally hailed, you know, but it's, in my opinion, and Diana too, I know agrees, you know, this man's name should be universally reviled. And yet authors gain personal prestige, let alone profit, by constantly jumping on the Churchill bandwagon. And that's why it's essential to read alternative writers, because this man is being lauded throughout the world. And he's constantly praised in the official history books. But the thing is, once you know about the man, then you know that the moment he is praised by any book on the bestseller list or on any table, then you know that that book is scurrilous in itself. Now, granted, there are people who don't do that. Your David Irvings, your John Charmleys, Alexander Coburn, Peter Miller, even the great Alexander Solzhenitsyn is no fan. Well, who do you think I would choose to listen to? Solzhenitsyn, this paragon of morality and bravery and genius and courage and humanity, or Winston Churchill and his biographers, right? And then we have of this year, recently, Pat Buchanan, who I love his work, and he wrote a book called Churchill, The Unnecessary War, which is a masterpiece. So Diana Springola, and if people want a modern up-to-date, again, like your books, Diana, are modern up-to-date, but Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, The Unnecessary War, he's also done interviews on YouTube so people can get a sample. But if we know about this man, like so many, if they're red carpeting him across the board, it's just because of the media chicanery, which people in the alternative movement are all up to speed on and know how deadly that is. You know, the media will present these wonderful stories about how he visited Bristol and was walking along the promenade and met an old 80-year-old woman, you know, who made him weep because she'd lost everything in the wars. You know, all this MI5 bullcrap to give him some human texture. You know, this is what you're constantly handed. But we can definitely open up today by, I want to just give complete newbies a little synopsis, right? Just take a three or four minutes. And also to get us onto, you know, launch the conversation here. So basically he was born in Blenheim Palace. And some writers have said that since that place was so splendid and so otherworldly and so grand, that he had a sense of entitlement, a sense of grandeur, and a sense of affluence. And there's nothing wrong with those things, nor is there being born in a palace a bad thing. But in his terms, the little man syndrome, he already had come in with a sense of this entitlement. This was counterpointed by the fact he was a total academic failure. This had to be borne in mind. He failed his entrance exams, both at Harrow, which is an elite school, but at other colleges as well. And his career was mostly launched by his family members, who themselves are fascinating characters. His mother was, courtesan would be the polite word, whore would be more like it, elite American, from the Jerome family. I think it was her father who was one of the kings of Wall Street, who's actually known as the king of Wall Street, Leonard Jerome. And the mother was a profligate of unimaginable proportions who not only, went around, as a courtesan and a mistress of some of the leading politicians and dignitaries in England, but also throughout the world. She was famous for her relationships with even princes and kings throughout the world. So she was very, very familiar with the corridors of power, and a lot of potentates, princes and kings and dukes owed her favors, which of course she used those to pump her son's career because he was a useless article. You usually send the idiot of the family into the church, but she found other uses for this psychopath. And of course he had a brother called John or Jack. The fatherhood is disputed. It probably wasn't Sir Randolph Churchill. But even if it was, that's no favor to him, because that guy was as mad as hell as well. He was a complete spendthrift from his earlier days. He didn't know how to save money, and everybody had remarked on that. Now, you got to bear this in mind that later on he was made Chancellor of the Exchequer. I can't think. What's the American equivalent of that? It would be the Treasurer or something?
Right, right.
And he bankrupted himself on numerous occasions, so great, great work there. But he also, for those who are interested, was a 33rd degree Mason, a member of the Studholm Lodge, and that means he was certainly Illuminati. He's also been seen in pictures of the Neo-Druids, These are not the Druids I talk about, but of course it would just be a secret society kind of effect. His father, Lord Randolph, was obviously in the Alpha Lodges of Freemasonry. These are the ones who surround the British royal family, who advise the royal family. People like, what's his name, the Duke of Kent, Mark, who literally was there at the coronation of the Queen. I mean, this kind of people, this is the circle you're talking about. So no lower level Freemasons here. When we always talk generally about bloodline Masons and so on, well, the Churchill family and probably the Jerome family and their related families, this now we're talking steering level Alpha Lodges of Freemasonry. So it's very important to study these people's history.
Sure.
He was apparently anti-Semitic, nearly done with this, but he was apparently anti-Semitic first. Apparently, I say, because that was a bogus lie from the start. Because a lot of people on the internet are constantly putting up his quotes against the Jews, the Jewish network. But that was stuff when he was a numbskull on the back benches. He was studying Nesta Webster and temporarily joined the chorus of, against world Jewry. But that was plucked very, very early on. So people are actually erroneous when they think of Churchill as one of the great anti-Semites. He was not anything of the kind. In fact, he and his ancestors were Philo-Semites, ardent Philo-Semites. And in fact, we'll find out in a minute that Churchill really served as their agent, just like Teddy Roosevelt had done. He was already in their pocket, and Woodrow Wilson and all the rest of them. Another thing that is extremely alarming is that Churchill was extremely close friends with Cecil Rhodes of the Round Table. We spoke earlier in our previous interview that is not an Anglophile network in the true sense of the Stars and Stripes or the British flag. No, this is the Star of David Anglophile network that was moving into the world with a Gentile face. But he was also very deep close friends with the Rothschilds, the Cassels, an extremely wealthy, less known Jewish family, the Sassoons. These are all mega drug barons, into opium dealing, not just famous diamonds and goldsmithing and banking. Opium was where they made most of their money. Again, that's not very well known. And his father, Randolph Churchill, was a close friend of Nathan Rothschild, staunchly pro-Jew. So even his predecessors. It's not a tuppence worth of sense that he was anti-Semitic. Politically, he was a complete opportunist. He went from, now get this, this is, even in our world today, is astonishing. He went from conservative, and he left them over a slight matter, became a liberal, left them to become a constitutionalist because he wasn't getting the podium, left the constitutionalist and came back to a conservative again. So four leapfrogs. They call John Kerry a flip-flopper. They don't know the meaning of the word. And yet this profligate, they're building statues to him. He couldn't even decide what seat suited his ass because, you know, as soon as there was a problem, he exited, which shows you how deeply he cared about his constituencies. And in fact, again, he failed in every seat and in every policy. And those are called the wilderness years. And also the phenomena of leaving these parties so egregiously is known in Britain as crossing the aisle. Well, this man crossed it four times. He was considered a profligate at the time by other politicians who had dedicated their whole lives to their parties. In war, he was a total half-hearted soldier, mostly a hanger-on to regiments. He had to petition those regiments to even take his sorry ass, and many of them did it reluctantly, again, only because of his mother. And in fact, he even resigned his military commission after even only 2 years. Psychologically, he was a complete megalomaniac. And in a letter to Delano Roosevelt, FDR, he said, were I to become Prime Minister of Britain, we could control the world. So this megalomania was on his mind all the time. More insidiously, he placated and praised Stalin, right? So here's a man who wanted to take down Germany, but was praising something infinitely worse than Germany. And he turned a blind eye to the millions of people who were slaughtered in Russia. He pushed this thing called Operation Keelhaul, right? So people can note all of this, listen back to what I'm saying. Go and check it out. Operation Keelhaul, which was the West sending back anti-communists into the arms of the KGB, actually sending them back so that them and their families would be wiped out. This has been airbrushed from history, but Churchill was pushing for that with his traitorous friends. He was a saboteur and a profiteer. He helped orchestrate economic collapses both in Britain and in America, and I hope that we can talk about that especially later on, because that's an extremely unknown aspect of his life. And he was a flagrant liar. That whole idea that he was a firebrand against universal communism were just empty warnings, as was his original escape from the Boer prison in his early days. That whole lie, that was just concocted. His mother sent money to the Boers. They let him go. He had to cross a thing like a puddle And of course, in his later on, he made it look like he was Robin Hood leaping like a swashbuckler, like Errol Flynn, you know, from the balcony, the battlements, and sword fencing his way across, Russia of South Africa. Total fiction. And he was an unprincipled, backstabbing Judas, because he undermined fellow politicians as soon as their backs were turned. People like Kitchener. There's even a rumor that he killed Kitchener. He arranged that Kitchener would die. No loss to the world. No loss to the world there, of course. But again, when we're dealing with psychopaths, it's the devil, you know. And also this man called Leopold Emery, a major proto-Zionist. But again, these two people, Lord Kitchener, why I'm bringing them up, Kitchener and Leopold Emery, at least they favored benign empire. Mad as they were, they still wanted these local countries to rule themselves with British help from above, but they were more into what's called benign empire. There is such a thing. Whereas Churchill vetoed them, stabbed them in the back, because he believed in precisely the opposite. He was an exponent of oppressive, draconian empire. So people have to remember there's two kinds of imperialism. He was distrusted, as I say, by most of his colleagues in government, and was considered an incompetent meddler for most of his actual political life. It's only in the final moments of the when he got brought in as prime minister for the Second World War that his ratings went up. And finally, he was an absolute scurrilous warmonger who advocated total war. I think you mentioned this, Diana, in the previous, the idea of total war. He was behind the Lusitania sinking, which was orchestrated. He was behind the bombing of Dresden, in which women and children and old people were targeted precisely, in, not only in retaliation, but in cold-blooded sadism to shake Germany to its roots. He is responsible for umpteen like civilian casualties throughout the world, both in the Middle East, in India, and in closer to home, imposing upon them blockades and food shortages, food blockades and intense bombings. And as I said, he reveled, we saw from the quotes that he reveled in the idea of battle. His early schoolmates say the only thing that Winston was good at in school is military strategy. And he used to call war, the bloodier the war, the more glamorous Churchill thought it was. He sold out Germany, ignoring Hitler's pleas for peace. And he even quotes saying, he had a quote, I quote him where he says, Germany is getting too strong and we must smash her. In 1936, he said, we will force Hitler into the war, whether he wants it or not. So this man should be reviled because he instigated the Second World War. He instigated, again, another thing that's been airbrushed, has been the famine in India, in Bengal, the province of Bengal, which had always been a hotbed of trouble. But he instigated this incredible 28 million, certainly 20 million is estimated, people died in this famine. Now, he wasn't working for the East India Company, but he was doing something similar to what they had done before, acting as the leaders of the... Now, this is a private company we're talking about, so you don't blame the whole of Britain for any of these atrocities. These are private companies, just as in the same way we have them today. But Churchill operated as a politician exactly as the leaders of the British East India Company operated. He interfered in the Middle East, causing millions of deaths there and total havoc. More to the point of our discussion today, he pushed the Turks, right, the Ottoman Turks, into their alliance with Germany. So on the geopolitical board, he made allies of people that probably might not have been allied with one another. And also he was a drunk, a complete profligate drunk, which is brought out by David Irving. And in fact, Norman Shelley, the actor, you can look up Norman Shelley, impersonated him. This has again been downplayed, but many people within BBC, within the media know that he, in fact, couldn't address a microphone properly. There are very few speeches of him. And if you can have umpteen speeches of Mussolini and Hitler and even Oswald Mosley, passionate speeches, why are there is a dearth of speeches from the great Winston Churchill? It's because then we'd see through his ruse in 10 seconds as he was an incompetent idiot who couldn't speak to a public audience. And then more, again, to our discussion importance, he was an agent of world Jewry. And he cared nothing for the English people, as the English people still think he does. He cared only for his masters who were now using him as a puppet, an agent, pulling him out of poverty. These Zionists, or Zionists, Zionit is how I prefer to call it. But again, as a Protestant, he was a philo-Semite, assisting the Jews to gain their homeland, just like Cromwell, Darby, Heckler, and his own predecessors had done, Churchill's own family members had done, and in the same way that the Vatican approved the Jewish settlement in Palestine, give the go-ahead, and so did the world Jewry. Elites, remember, not the masses. You mentioned, Deanna, that only 1% of world, of the Jews of the world actually wanted it, but we're not talking about them. They were goaded into, crowbarred into it by this extreme elite with their Gentile founders behind them. So this is something that people who just fixate on the Jewish question have to understand. Please try to implicate these people as well. Bring them on board. It's not just Jewish, wall-to-wall Jewish conspiracy, okay? And this Churchill was one of them, a proto-Zionist, a founder of Zionism. He pushed the Balfour Declaration. So we can finish the synopsis there. But yeah, any comments, Deanna, just on that synopsis alone?
Wow. He was a terrible, terrible person, as you have very well described. And he was, even his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, as you mentioned, was friends with Nathan M. Rothschild, and he actually borrowed money from the Rothschilds to go to South Africa to look at the natural resources in that area. And Randolph died before he ever repaid the loan. But yeah, they were friends, and certainly Churchill was a friend of Nathan Rothschild as a boy. So they were always in bed with the upper level Jews, and they, despite the things that Churchill said about, oh gosh, in fact, one time he said, if ever our country were in danger, we should have Hitler to be at the head of our country, or something to that effect. And within minutes, a very short time, he was borrowing money to pay off his loans, and so they were always indebted to the elite Jews. And
that's his private debts, isn't it? He went bankrupt on several occasions.
Exactly, and even with the Boer Wars, which he was, you know, involved with, and those were early on, and he was altogether. He was in favor of total war, and which is a terrible, terrible thing. I mean, the first Boer War, when was it? It was 1980 to 81. Certainly he wasn't involved with that one. But they were the people who owned, the companies that created weapons. They tested their weaponry in South Africa so that they could figure out what to use. And the Boers, I mean, they went in there and absolutely, totally destroyed the land. I mean, they salted it so that the land would be worthless. And this was something that Churchill was all in favor of. And it's always been about resources, whether you're talking about South Africa, whether you're talking about Palestine, it's always, always been about resources. And the Dead Sea was one of the most, has incredible mineral value, absolutely incredible. And so when people think, why would these people want Palestine? I mean, it's just a little piece of property. I think it's the size of, I mean, it's very small, very small. Why would they want Palestine? Well, it's because of the mineral value there, the mineral wealth there. And that has always been the case. Warfare is about seizing resources.
I have a quote on the potash company. A little bit later, we'll get into that. But we're not just bashing the man, right? The Jewish Encyclopedia has a passage that admits that 6,000 pounds a year is what his ancestor, right, the first Duke of Marlborough, because Churchill was called the Duke of Marlborough, he's from this line, and Duke is the highest rank under Prince. I mean, you know, Baron, Earl, they're all lower. Duke is like the Duke of Westminster, or, you know, it's very high rank, right? So John Churchill, the first Duke, we're probably talking 16th century here, was already being given 6,000 pounds a year by the Dutch Jew Solomon Medina. So tassel to purse, right? It's established, the Jewish connection. And you're right. They are about economics, about the monetary seizure. Remember, wasn't it one of them? Jacob Schefter, Warburg said, give me the control over the money of a land and that's the end of it. I'll make the laws and the rules.
Sure. Absolutely. And, by conquest or consent. And, so you either give it to us or we'll come in and we'll bomb you. And of course, that's what, the U.S. military has done in the Middle East. But yes, it's always been about resource seizure. And it doesn't matter how many people they kill. And certainly Churchill. Oh my gosh. He was such a warmonger. And he believed that in total war. But he also believed that, well, we can go in and we can shake hands afterwards and everything will be just fine. But that certainly doesn't work. But you know, the first person who actually thought about giving Palestine, to the Jews was Napoleon Bonaparte. And he was a Freemason and he, had this proclamation, which was dated April 20th, 1799, that he was going to restore Palestine to them. And he had a meeting. It was called the Assembly of Notables. And this was held on October 6th, 1807. He issued this proclamation to the Jewish communities in Europe. He invited them to send delegates to the Sanhedrin, which, by the way, is still operating. And the Sanhedrin is, they exercise authority over the Jews worldwide. And they have judges, financiers, intellectuals, orators, and politicians who hold meetings. And they decide what is essential for the welfare of Israel. So this is still going on. And Nathan Rothschild, of course, got into this. He relocated to Manchester, England, because that's where the acquiescent politicians were. And they're always about getting politicians in whatever nation they can to go along with their plans. And it doesn't matter. They have no loyalty to any country because they are globalist. These people are globalist. It doesn't matter whether they live in China, which many of them did live in China. It doesn't matter where they live. They are globalist.
The Sassoons made their money in Ottoman Empire. They were more of the Middle East. Then a lot of that family went to the Far East after the Ottoman Empire fell. The Sassoons were summarily sent as lords to rule for the British, i.e. Jewish Empire over in China. So yeah, they've been worldwide globalist network. And that, so when these Churchills and other people are waving a national flag or FDR or something, everybody falls for that. It's ludicrous.
Exactly.
And they'll hide behind that, right? Like if you think about it and just think back to the empire expansion and whatnot going on throughout history before, you know, the Romans, the Greeks, etc., where you've got these individuals that if it is about resources and controlling resources, they're going to fight amongst themselves over the land in the way that mafias fight over turfs, you know, turf wars and all this. Gangs do the same thing. So when you see this at the high level where you've got these psychopaths that get into power, they wave the flag of the people. They say what, you know, they need to say to have, you know, the people worship them. And then if you are in bed with the people that run the media, then all the books, magazines, everything, all the documentaries, they all get made to praise the people that are actually out there who don't give a crap about the country and the people that live in it. They have an ulterior agenda and they are, as you've said many times, Michael, behind the lodge door, meaning they're not just political leaders. They are also handshaking behind the door of some of these secret fraternal orders and they have their own agenda that supersedes any average person's conception of politics or geopolitics or whatever. It has to do with resource control. And that brings the question to bear. You got a guy like Churchill who's willing to instigate and incite this war worldwide and reveling in it and enjoying it. And that means they view the human beings that have to go and fight these wars for them as resources. And then you read their writings and then you've got all these other things and they're like, well, the human beings are resources too. And so we're just going to treat them like cattle. And this is basically, it's like human farming. That's when you really boil it all down.
Sure. Cannon fodder. That's all the military is. And
that's why I started my press day there with saying that the man was born in privilege, which is not a bad thing, but it can be bad if you're already psychopathic. Born to degenerate parents who've never taught you anything but morality, probably abandoned you and neglected you. And then it's like the kid who wants to pull leaves off trees and stamp on little ants and insects. This is the kind of creature we're talking about. Now, in your book, you bring out that his mother, Jerome, of the Jerome family, was American. So he was definitely a fan of America, spent a lot of time in America. The ones who made him rich after he'd been bankrupt were American Jews, but some people would say that, maybe you can comment on this, that he felt that if you placate the Jews, if you warm up to the Jews, whether they're in America or they're in Europe, it's the American Jew who's the richest and the most powerful. So if you ever need America to come into one of your wars, it'll be talking to the Jews that will do it. He had already sensed this because it had already been the status quo probably since 1860, with the Franco-Prussian War, then coming up to the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution. You appeal to these Jews, and if they're your friend, they'll bring America in as the heavyweight. What do you have to say about that?
Well, absolutely. In fact, that was the deal that Wilson made, and that was, of course, after he'd funded the Bolsheviks. But the whole idea of getting America into the war was Bernard Baruch. And of course he made millions and millions of dollars in World War I. He made $50 million just off copper alone because he knew what to invest in, and that's what he did. And he was in charge of purchasing for the U.S. government military. And it was amazing how they got the Americans to go with this war. And they did this with a lot of propaganda. They did it with film. They did it with using movie stars. And I'm talking about World War I and II. They always get people to endorse the war. And you see it now on TV where you see these the Wounded Warrior Project. They come forth they've lost their legs and they say, oh, I would do it again in a heartbeat. And I mean, it's crazy that people are so willing to do this. And it's because they have used various tactics to get people's allegiance. They have used, Christianity. They've used, religion to get people to think that these Jews need to be in Palestine, that this is their homeland and that they need to be restored to their homeland. And so they will use any kind of tactic at all to get the allegiance of the populations. And it's amazing to me that people who say they're religious and endorse Christian values think nothing of going and bombing people to smithereens and destroying infrastructure. How can people do that? I mean, it's just amazing to me.
That's right.
Well, religion gives you the ultimate justification, and that's what we're seeing. And it's like you've said, like they use religion as a mask. And this was why in America there was supposed to be a separation between church and state. It was supposed to be that, but it really has never been that, unfortunately. And we've had degrees of it, I guess, but ultimately they know that the religions play to the emotional decisions that people make. They base their decisions off of emotional biases and reactions. And so when you're raised in a particular religious belief system, and then you've caught on to somebody because as a politician or as a media figure, they represent what you think is the values of your religion. And then they go off and do something that you know, it sounds good on paper what they're going to do for you. But, really it's not, it's a divide and conquer tactic. It's a strategy and it's psychological warfare. That's really what a lot of people really miss with this, is that there's a psychological war that has to happen first before the physical war can actually be incited. Cause you need people to be willing and passionate to go and fight these wars and to believe in what they're doing. And the only way to do that, you can't just appeal to their logic, because people would figure it out and go, yeah, I really don't want to go and die on the battlefield and kill people. You have to have an emotionally driven approach to it, so that they abandon any of their reason and logic and their higher order thinking. And we see the same thing happening with, you know, what they've done with these terror networks in the Middle East. And it's incredible the impact these religions, who all fly the flag of peace, how much war they've caused psychologically and physically on this planet.
Yeah, like die for the Old Testament, right? Die for the God of the Old Testament. He's done enough killing, and that religion will spur you on, as it's done Protestants and Catholics, these philo-Semites that I've been talking about. You know, that is the religious aspect, that if you, just in the same way the Muslims were told that, you know, have 72 virgins and go to a paradisical place for sacrificing themselves. But, I was thinking that, just in the same way that, it was like a Colonel Mandel House was behind Woodrow Wilson, right? So in all of these situations, you know, it would have been the Rothschilds behind Churchill, the money men, like this Cassell family, super wealthy. But see, to establish that he was really a Jewish agent is very important to do, I think, because there's that crap out there. I didn't even put his quotes against the Jews, you see, on my Douglas Reed website, because I see through the smokescreen. I mean, he met his own wife. I can't remember her name now, but he met her at the house of the granddaughter of Nathan Rothschild. This is how close friends they were. He met his own wife at a dinner party at the Rothschild residence. And in fact, showing how closely he worked for the Jews, there was a regulation, you probably know it very well, Regulation 18B. That was put out, right, to imprison hundreds of British people who opposed the war. So freedom, dib, dib, dib. Yeah, in Britain, the government issued this regulation 18B, people can look it up, we'll put the links below, to imprison, you know, like they did in Ireland under the internment, right? And that's how Lady Moseley and Oswald Mosley and Captain Ramsay, who wrote a great book called The Nameless War, found themselves locked up. People in military, people, captains, majors, all sorts of people, found themselves, and it was actually Churchill who pushed it through the actual regulation was created by Lord Victor Rothschild. Then it was handed to Churchill, who pushed it through. So tassel to purse all the way along. Do you have a comment about that particular regulation?
Well, they did the same thing during the so-called Civil War. Lincoln had all kinds of people put in jail who were opposed to the war. That's just what you do. You have to conceal, or you have to discredit or incarcerate the people who have a voice, a reasonable voice, that are asking questions. They do that during every war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, as a matter of course, almost.
Right.
And he, more problematically, he knew David, one of these characters that was an Ottoman, one of the young Turks. We didn't mention his name in the previous one, but another one they should be knowing about is this guy David. It's spelled D-J.
Yes. Huh? Yes, isn't that a funny spelling?
B-J-A-V-I-D. So David with a J after the D. And this is a bona fide open Jew. Oh, you don't, because people talk about crypto Jews. Look, this guy was open Jews, as many of the others we mentioned before. And yet he was a founding member of the Young Turks. Churchill's best buddy over there, you see? Yes. And these are people who were heavily supported by Jewish spies like Parvus and others, you know, from Russia.
Right.
So, and not to mention the elite Jews. Again, we're dealing with the elite Jews from Salonika. So Churchill is right in the middle of these people. He's being used as an agent by them as well.
Right.
And of course, it's they who wanted a temporary alliance, a peculiar alliance. This is one of these historical alliances that doesn't seem to make sense. It will when you start to understand the domino effects and other things that we're talking about, these satellite issues that have shaped our world. Why would Germany and the Ottomans be allies? Well, they were forced together because Russia, being the main enemy, right? They're wondering that Germany might become an ally of Russia in order to crush the Ottoman Empire or the Armenians or whatever. So these peculiar alliances, this is how politics works. But I have two quotes, if you allow me. I've got two quotes here, which really opens up another door here. And it shows that, it says here that John Buchan, his name, he's an author, the popular novelist of imperialism, who had been Lord Alfred Milner's private secretary in South Africa, and who on Milner's recommendations later became director of information services for Lloyd George's government, expressed this view, right, the following view, in the first chapter of his classic novel, The 39 Steps. Now, people have seen the movie made by Alfred Hitchcock, who, as I said, was a propagandist as well. He also worked for the MI5. But in this extraordinary movie, which is meant to be about hunting communists, but there's always a subplot, and then the passage I want to read is this from Buchan. Away behind all the governments and the armies, there was a big subterranean movement going on, engineered by very dangerous people. Of course, he's talking about this Zionist network. That explained a lot. Things that happened in the Balkan War, how one state suddenly came out on top while alliances were made and broken, why certain men disappeared, and where the sinews of war came from. The aim of the whole conspiracy was to get Russia and Germany at loggerheads. The Jew was behind it. So here's a quote from a famous mainstream author. Right? Yeah. The Jew was behind it, and the Jew hated Russia worse than hell. This is the return match for the pogroms. The Jew is everywhere with an eye like a rattlesnake. He is the man who is ruling the world just now, and he has the knife in the empire of the Tsar. So, a major author, right, has written it, not prevaricating at all. Yet today, because of the, you know, who is it? Voltaire said, you always know who's controlling the world when you cannot say the name of that group beyond a whisper.
Right.
And it's the word Jew. We've been prohibited. We've been so mind controlled that nobody can even speak up about this. You know, again, kudos to you for doing so in your career. But sadly, yeah, this alliance between the Germans and the Ottomans happened. For the Germans went along with it because they were in a hard place. They were caught between a rock and a hard place. Russia fell eventually anyway, didn't it, to the communists and Bolsheviks in 1917, although they tried to get in 1905. So as early as 1905, the socialist revolutionaries we talked to before were already at the door of Russia, because they knew if they took Russia out, then Britain wouldn't need to fear. And that's exactly what Russia did. They pulled their troops out of the war so that the slaughter of kindred nations could continue. Germany had funded the Bolsheviks, right, in order to get them to pull their soldiers out of the war, thinking that that would aid the Germans. So each of the, there was a blindfolding going on. There was complete machinations going on, all centered around Russia's role and the Tsar's role. And we know that something's seriously wrong here, because Britain officially tells you that it was a nightmare, you know, what was happening in Russia and the German belligerents and all, and we must save Russia. And yet when it came to it, George VII, the cousin of the Tsar, wouldn't receive the Tsar and his family to Britain. They left him to be slaughtered by the Bolsheviks. So the official story is patently full of lies.
Right.
That Britain was against this.
Right. Well, they were even behind the invasion of the Philippines, the invasion, the Spanish-American War, when you had Cecil Rhodes and Alfred Milner contacting Roosevelt and urging for the U.S. seizure of the Philippines and the spoils from the Spanish-American War. So
for resources?
Yes, there was a lot of resources there.
Empire.
Plus, it just gave them another place where they could have influence around that area. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, see, to me, it's outstanding that official history paints the, first of all, they don't even want to tell you that it was Jews who assassinated the Tsar and his family. That word Jew just doesn't appear in the whole thing. It's just put down in history and that's the end of it. It's just the Soviets. But then clearly history's wrong when the British government and the British people think that what happened, right, the Bolshevik takeover of Russia, in other words, the famous Bolshevik Revolution, is a catastrophe for Russia. Why is the king and the nobility of England not accepting the Tsar too sweet? They had sent their spies, and the spies were saying, yes, it's time to get them out. It's time to get them out. These documents exist where the spies were saying, give us the go and we'll have the Tsar and his family out of Russia.
Sure.
And the British family, the highest ministers, the king himself said, no, we don't think we'll bother with that. They took 80 million of his money that had been banked in England, and that all went into their pockets, these Windsors. And
that's
they left him to rot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you leave your family to rot, you're not that perturbed about the Bolshevik takeover. And then people like yourself have written why. Anthony Sutton, yourself. It's because the whole bloody Bolshevik revolution is funded from London and New York.
Sure. And they wanted to get rid of all the monarchies. They didn't want to relocate them. They wanted to get rid of them. And that's why they went into the Ottoman Empire, to destroy the empire, to water it down and get rid of the monarchies. That was their main purpose. Because then they could go in and they could influence politicians that followed, such as the Young Turks. So they said...
Now,
go ahead.
Well, you mentioned, Napoleon, right? Could the Tsar, could these other potentates, and you mentioned Napoleon, when they wanted to give a Palestinian homeland, we just breezed past it in the last interview, but it's to get rid of them.
Sure.
Because they knew what surreptitious chicanery the Jew does on a subterranean level. So some of the politicians who favored Zionism wasn't because they were Zionists. They went, look, anything that gets rid of these agitators, right? I'm for that. If you have to go to Madagascar, if you got to send them to Uganda, if you've got to send them to Arizona, you know, let it happen because we need this group out. Isn't that true?
Sure. Sure. But there are certain politicians who are taking money from them and they have enough politicians on the take, that they're going to succeed, such in this country. And when you look at the protocols say that we're going to choose all the presidents. We're going to do all of that. And when you also consider the agreement between Britain and America back in 1897, they agreed that they would collaborate in invading countries and that they would divide the spoils. And so when the Jews have been in charge for that long, since 1897, I mean, they had a pretty good stronghold on Britain, on the United States. And, look at Germany. I mean, Germany is still under the rule. They have never been able to get a new constitution. They are still, I can't even think of the word. They have been, led by the Jews since the end of World War II. And paying reparations, oh my gosh, they've paid so many reparations to the Israelites or to the Israeli state and have provided them with ships and all kinds of things. And we're talking millions of dollars in reparations that they really don't deserve. The Germans didn't do what the Jews have claimed that they did.
That's right. Yeah. Not by a long chalk. You know, you've heard of Edwin Montague, right? From the Montague family. He was a Jew. Cause remember, we have to, again, not disclaim, but at the same time, when we're talking about Jew, we've got to realize we're talking about this elite globalist clan who are not really even ultimately that Jewish because they're not religious Jews at all. And this can be proven by the details. First of all, as we said, only 1% of the world Jewry even gave Palestine a moving there. We'll get to the potash company in a minute, which is the key, but as you say, the resources. But Edwin Montague, a Jew from a leading family, very prestigious, look up his name, Edwin Montague, he opposed it with all his might because he said that, look, well-meaning Jews are prospering in the Western lands. We are the bankers. We are, you know, the art critics, or we are the, you know, we own all the antiques business and all of these other things that they're into. Cigarettes, they push tobacco. Lion's tea shops is run by them. They're even into computers, you know. So he was saying we've just got ensconced in the West and had a modicum of freedom and liberty to operate in these lands, which used to keep us in, you know, confined and whatever. What the hell do we want to up roots for and move to Palestine, you know, to this complete, you know, wilderness or whatever. So you had the elite Jews. So we're only paraphrasing what some Jewish men stood up their whole lives on public podiums to critique. So our critiques are not based on any kind of anti-Semitism. We've already shot that down before because how can you be anti-Semitic when you're dealing with people who were of Turkish origin anyway in the first place? But the point I was going to make was what David had brought up about these, when we talk about even Gentile founders of Zionism, Probably it would be better to say Gentile Masonic founders of Zionism. So again, it comes across clearly because this philo-Semitism, this fascination, obsessive fascination with the Old Testament isn't your average Gentile involved. Most Protestants know that they have nothing to do with it. Most Catholics blame the Jews for the killing of Jesus. You see, this is the average churchgoer. So we're obviously not talking about them. We're talking about a sort of pseudo-intellectual class who's become obsessed, like your Lord Lloyd Georges and others, with this Old Testament. And there are such people. But they're upset. They get obsessed with it because it's in Masonry, which is riddled with Jewish old traditions, right?
Absolutely.
That this comes, wouldn't you say?
Yes. When you look at the number of people, particularly the military leaders who are Freemasons, it's just amazing. And we're talking Churchill was a Freemason, FDR was a Freemason, Stalin was Freemason, Churchill was a Freemason, all of these people, Freemasons. And as
you can even see it in the founding of certain
parts.
Go ahead.
Oh, Napoleon. Yeah, exactly. You can also see it in the founding of a lot of these, pseudo Christianity type groups where you've got like, you know, Jehovah Witnesses and the Mormons, etc. A lot of their leaders and founders were also Masons. And this has come out recently too. So, this is huge. And Michael, I wondered if you could, you're talking about the word Jew. You were saying previously in an interview, I'm trying to remember which one it was. You were referring to these people as Judites just because you had, you know, wanted to clarify the difference there. But that term Jew, wasn't it originally a rank? It wasn't necessarily because if this whole thing about the Jewish people and all of that, you know, even shot down by their own scholars was a fabrication, then if we're saying Jew and we're talking elite Jew here, Isn't that originally in Masonry or in, I'm trying to remember what tradition it would be, but wasn't that term really talking about a rank of a person, that they had achieved a particular royal rank of stature?
Yeah, it was used in many contexts, but as the word Jew, it's a J-E-W, was nothing to do with the ones we call religious Jews. It was actually borrowed from the Eleusinian Greek myth tradition, where one of the ranks of the priestarchy was Hebrew, which actually is a real word, Ibaru, and nothing to do with them either, and Jew. But it's okay to say Judean, and it's okay to say Judite. Even then, you've got to use it with brackets. Be very careful, because we're talking about such history here, and such chicanery, and such appropriation. But yeah, the Israelites are the 10 tribes, the Judeans, or the Judites, are the 2 tribes. Then you get your Levites, you see. You have to look into their own history, because if you're going to show up this group for what it is, it's psychopathy and all the rest of it. You like we're doing, quoting from within, you know, going within and understanding where they appropriated these terms. If people go to my Douglas Reed site, they will see that I've got stuff on the Jew. If they go to Astrotheology site, I think it's click on the link called Moses Fraud, and it will show you that the word Jew wasn't even used by any of these people for over 1,000 years after the time of Moses. Maybe even more. It's almost into AD, and then you still have to add 600 years before that word actually started to be used in the context that it is now. And as for words like Israel, oh my God, and the image of the Star of David, those are extremely modern as well. So when you see the sham of this, that's why I'm losing patience with people who don't want to learn what the true history is. And they continue to believe the newspapers. They continue to believe these best-selling books and official reports. Then there's no bloody hope for you. Because, you know, like Deanna's written these wonderful books. The books are out there and they show facts. So it's about believing in facts. And you're right. This Judge Brandeis, who was a very close friend of Churchill, basically is one of the people that pushed Zionism. Zionism kind of flagged, didn't it, in Europe at some point? Because again, so few Jews were into it. This is the fact I'm going to repeat again and again. And in fact, it flagged so badly that Theodor Herzl looked like, it wasn't going to work. And then suddenly a famous Mason, the famous Judge Brandeis, can't remember his first name. He picked it up and pushed it. Louis Brandeis. Mm-hmm. He picked it up, Zionism, as a personal crusade and pushed it amongst the elites. And then finally, it was American Jews that caught on. And then they were getting infected. And then finally, the continental Jews went, yeah, this is not bad. But even then, the continental Jews who followed the Americans were the poorest of the poor, weren't they? They were the Russian ghettoites. Who sure. said, yeah, maybe this might be good after all. And sure. The Americans went with it. The last point there, and you can maybe comment on this, is the American Jew listened to Brandeis because they had been in the country only a very short time and were rootless, unlike Irish, unlike Italians that had come to America who had deep roots. The Jew was a wanderer, and by the time the Jew even immigrated to America, he felt so rootless that then when they handed them this rotten carrot of Zionism, they went for it hook, line, and sinker and regressed to this Old Testament sort of level. Isn't that correct?
Well, they saw the Jewish people who brought them over, like from Russia, because they were suffering from the pogroms and everything. And so they saw them as saviors, so they went ahead and did whatever the group, the elite Jews, told them to do. But Brandeis was a political advisor to Wilson, a very close political advisor. And so it wasn't the fact that it was the elite Jews in America, although they were controlling the Jews that arrived here, but it was also the Jews were controlling the political picture with Wilson.
And the media.
Absolutely. The media was totally controlled.
Remember, was it in our last interview that we finished off with that quote about the San Francisco drug lords, the first one where this Isaac Levin family, I mean, they were involved in the media, they were involved in the first drugs, and yet the world insists on looking at
Italians
and Irish, I don't know what, Chinamen, you know. You and I, David, will do one thing on Murder Incorporated soon. We have, the gang, the actual mafia, right. The Jewish mafia. We'll definitely do something on that. But let's pause now. I want to start the next section with a quote from Deanna about this key issue of the potash company. Why Israel has the real reason, because there's speculation galore on why would you want to go to this wasteland that the Ottoman Turks, the Sultan has forbidden you to go there. There's people living there, right? You can't go there. It's been prohibited for hundreds of years to the Jew, but suddenly something happened where the gates were wide open and the Gentile politicians, you know, they pulled out the red carpet and suddenly things moved quickly between 1900 and 1940. Things escalated, and there's a very important reason that Deanna brings out in her book that I have yet to find another book that really deals with. So we'll start with that quote and move on there, maybe to talk about Churchill's influence also in the British stock market crash, which made him a fortune, and then the American stock market crash by which he and his Jewish overlords then cashed in a massive way. So can we do that?
Sure.
Yeah, that sounds good. So we'll wrap up this first hour, and thanks for that. Great introduction. So many points that we're going to dissect further. So join us over at unslaved.com, and we'll catch you guys in the next section.
Want to be more than a subscriber and explore these mysteries deeper? David and Michael open up the archive of research and take you through more advanced knowledge reserved for more serious study. Become an Unslaved member and receive unlimited access to full-length downloadable MP3s and HD video of all Unslaved episodes ad-free. Be seeing you here next week at unslaved.com.